Welcome to Real Talk. I'm Susan McCabe, your host. And I want to mention that our theme music is written by Luke McQuillan, written and performed by Luke McQuillan, especially for this show. And I am grateful not only to Luke, but to my producer, Kaya Boding, who helps me put this show together every Wednesday. Real Talk is, I like to call it, the show about anything, anything that piques my curiosity and hopefully yours. So if you've got a subject you'd like an expert to address, send your suggestions to realtalk@voiceofvashon.org. I am particularly honored and excited today to have with me Robin Swycord, who is the screenwriter and director of Wakefield, which is going to premiere here at the Vashon Theater tomorrow night. Welcome, Robin.
Hi, so glad to be here.
I'm so happy to have you here. And tell me why you chose to premiere Wakefield here at Vashon Island.
Well, I have been coming to Vashon Island for 27, 28 years now. We first came here with our little kids for the summer. We immediately fell in love with the island and we got a place here. And so it has become a place of refuge for us as writers, a great place to be creative. Also for our friends, we're thanked in the introductions of a number of novels because we've loaned our house to friends who are trying to get past chapter one. and it still is a place where we come frequently to just be by ourselves in nature. So I, over the years, I've gotten such an attachment to Vashon. It figures hugely in our family's life. It gave us things that we never imagined we would get out of a summer place. So I thought it would be nice to do something for Vashon.
So, and you sure are. This is a benefit for the Vashon Community Care Center, and it is tomorrow night, folks, at the Vashon Theater. I hope you can still get tickets, but you can get tickets online at vashontheater.com. This is a, Wakefield has a really interesting plot. It's about a man who retreats to an attic. Where did that come from?
You know, it came from the brain of E.L. Doctorow, who is a novelist and short story writer who I've loved since I discovered him in college. And one of the fortunate things in my life is that his writing life coincided with my adult reading life. I got his first novels when I was in college, and I got every book that came out. Everything he produced, I read. And I've just been a dyed-in-the-wool E.L. Doctorow fan. So when I came across the short story, The New Yorker, something about that short story hooked me. It turns out that he himself was adapting from Nathaniel Hawthorne's short story of the same name.
Interesting.
And in that short story, Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote about a man in London who walks out of his house, kisses his wife goodbye, and then secretly goes across the street to a rooming house and takes a room where he proceeds to watch his wife coming and going for the next 20 years.
Wow.
So in Nathaniel Hawthorne's short story, he says to the reader, you can follow along with me because I'm the one telling the story, but if you have an idea of your own about how to tell this story, you're more than welcome to write your own. And a lot of literary authors have taken him up on that, including E.L. Doctorow. So in Doctorow's version of it, he's a guy that lives in the suburbs of New York City, probably somewhere in maybe Connecticut or Westchester County, and he commutes. So he's not that close to his family. You know, he's the guy that goes off to the office and then comes back late at night and they reheat dinner for him. And he has a wife that he's in a kind of fraught relationship with. And on this night, when he comes home, something happens which causes him to go up into the attic of his garage. And he discovers from there that he can see his wife and children in the kitchen.
Oh.
And he sees that his wife is still angry with him about a marital argument from the night before. And he decides, you know, I'm just going to wait until she goes to bed. And then he's off to the races. He keeps delaying his return until he is up there for 9 months.
Just 9 months, not 20 years.
Not 20 years. I think 20 years for me stretched credulity because it's a long time to fill doing nothing except sitting in a rooming house waiting for your wife to come outside.
So this, it sounds to me like you've taken Doctorow's premise and updated it to speak to modern American life. And Do we know why this man chooses to basically step out of his life completely?
I think we understand why he does without giving up any sense of mystery about why he does it. Human behavior can be very strange. And this is a strange movie.
This is strange. Yeah. You're kind of partial to strange human stories. You were nominated.
What does that say about me?
Yeah, right. Wow. That's another question. What does that say about you? You were nominated for an Oscar for your screenplay about Benjamin Button, which was about a guy who goes from old age to infancy.
That's right.
That's a strange backwards. Human story. Yeah, ages yeah. backwards.
That was another adaptation from F. Scott Fitzgerald's short story.
Yeah.
And that was seriously updated. He had said it starting in the Civil War days and ending in the Jazz Age. And I had the idea that I really wanted to do. I was writing my first drafts, I think, in 1988. And I was thinking I should do something about the entire 20th century. You know, this would be a chance to sort of look back over the whole century.
Yeah.
And so I started it in 1900 and ended it in the early 90s.
That was a fascinating film. You've been writing screenplays since the 80s. Am I right about that?
That's right. I sold my first screenplay in 1980.
How does a person start with that? How does a person who's got a good screenplay manage to get it to the screen through the business of Hollywood, what kind of skill does it take in addition to being able to write? What are the skills that it takes to get it to screen?
Well, one of the things about independent film particularly, and Wakefield was an independently financed film, as were a number of the movies that I've made, not the big studio pictures like Memoirs of a Geisha and Matilda and Benjamin Button, but a lot of the other things that I've written have all been independently financed. And it's one of the ways that interesting work gets done. Because all of that work is entrepreneurial. It all starts with someone saying, I know that no one wants to see this, but. And then you have to bring your collaborators together. You have to get the cast. I had to go to Bryan Cranston, you know, hat in hand, please read my screenplay through his agent. And he did, which is right away a big win, just getting him to read. And then that he liked it and wanted to meet. Well, that was all to the good. You know, then that he said, well, I'd like to do it, but I'm busy for the next year and a half. So now you're biting your nails for a year and a half. Mm. Like, will he get cast in something else that he wants to do more than this? Because there's no contract holding him.
Oh, that was my question. No
right?
contract.
There's no contract holding him. And then that he really made himself available, that he loved the project enough. And you're asking people to work for very little money, mostly for scale usually, and there's not a big payday later. It's really for love, these indie movies. And so it takes a faith in yourself, a faith in the project, and an ability to bring people together around your vision in order to make it come true.
And that's an incredible skill in and of itself, to be able to gather people around your vision. Was it the script or the fact that you got Bryan Cranston attached to it so early that sold it to producers, to financiers?
Well, the first producers were with me just in spirit immediately. I brought them something that they fell in love with and they said, this is going to be impossible to get made. Let's get started. But for money follows cast in indie films.
Ah.
And so when you have people who aren't well known, then your movie is going to be made for very little money. And that's what Sundance Film Festival is all about, is people who don't really have movie stars but have made interesting movies. And so Sundance gave those filmmakers a forum to show their films to the world. Over time, that festival also began to show movies with real movie stars in it. And so now it's a mix. But financing comes because you have actors that are recognizable all over the world. So once we had Bryan Cranston, we had not quite enough money to shoot the movie.
Mm.
And so that year and a half that we were waiting was a year in which internationally he became better known because his television series Breaking Bad got to Europe for the first time. And so all of a sudden there was a fan base in countries, even though he wasn't known as a movie star yet at that time, people were interested in him, and we were able to get a little bit more money. And then after we were cast Jennifer Garner, she had some value internationally.
Yeah.
And international drives the financing for independent film.
Is that a fairly recent development in filmmaking?
In independent film, I think it's always been a strong component, at least for the last 20 years. Because for people here in this country to finance a movie independently, they want to know that it's not going to be contingent on becoming a big hit in North America. They need to know that other people in the world also believe in the film. And so there are foreign sales companies that are set up to, and there are film festivals like the American Film Market, and the Berlin is a film market. So that festival. Mm-hmm. And so people go with projects and try to seek financing from these foreign sales companies who then give you estimates. Well, the estimates on our film were lower than what our budget was going to be. And our budget was not very big.
Mm-hmm.
So that was our starting place. But as we, it took us 4 years to make, it took us 4 years to get financed. And then once we were shooting, we only had 20 days. It was such a small production that we had to get it all in 20 days because we couldn't afford to go any longer.
Right, you can't afford to go over budget.
That's right.
Now, you were telling us off mic today that Wakefield is going to be released in art houses. Is the art house release an easier distribution to get than major cinemas?
Well, there are many more theaters that are not art house. For instance, yeah. Right now in Seattle, there's a slight shortage, I understand, of art houses because someone is renovating. So that's not so much of a problem when you're showing movies at the Cineplex, is that there are going to be enough screens, usually, mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. most communities. So it is hard to always get the screens that you want in that world. But in the art house world, you have smaller rollouts. They're very review driven. Like studios have the ability to buy advertising,
right,
and really sell a movie to the unsuspecting viewer.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas indie movies tend to be driven entirely by what's trending on Rotten Tomatoes and what people are saying, you know, the film critics are saying on NPR and in various publications, but particularly these days online.
Have you invited critics to the premiere tomorrow night?
No, it's this film has been only been reviewed by trade press at the festivals that we've gone to. We went to Telluride 4 days after I finished the movie, and then
that was a whirlwind experience.
That was a whirlwind experience. I'm happy to tell you some fun stories out of that one. And then we were at Toronto, and so industry, you know, the people that write for Variety and Hollywood Reporter and sort of industry oriented mm-hmm. websites did see it and reacted to it, but it hasn't really premiered yet. This is what's so cool about getting to do it here, is that no one will have seen this except a festival audience when we screen tomorrow night.
This is pretty exciting.
Are there people who get to be the first audience?
Are you going to be here tomorrow night, and are you going to do a Q&A after the film?
Yes, I'm looking forward to doing a Q&A, and somebody who lives on Vashon will be the Q to my A, Peter Rynearson, who I met on the ferry probably 20 years ago. We struck up a conversation about his kids, and we have been friends since then. And he became one of the angels who helped finance the film.
Uh-huh.
He became a producer on the film. And all of those people, there are about 26 of them, all of those people have my gratitude forever. Because people who invest at that early stage are looking at either just a script, or in the case of Peter Rynearson, a few scenes that have already been shot.
They're taking a chance.
They're taking a huge, huge risk. And that, you know, we had seasoned financiers. They were all people who had made money in Broadway. And they believed in Bryan Cranston. He had won the Tony for something that he did on Broadway, a story about LBJ. He did a phenomenal performance as LBJ.
Yes.
And so it was people who loved Bryan Cranston and really believed in him who showed up to finance this movie.
Well, and you've got a pretty good track record, too. It's not like,
I was a safe bet. I wasn't scary about me.
Yeah.
But I'm not a known director. There's only a handful of directors that could get a movie financed on the strength of their name.
And I want to talk to you more about being a screenwriter and director as a woman in Hollywood after I thank Windermere Real Estate. Voice of Ashon thanks Windermere for its support making this program and our emergency alert service possible. This program is Real Talk. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, and I'm talking with Robin Swikeward, who is here to premiere her new film, Wakefield, with Bryan Cranston at the Vashon Theater tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. Do I have
That's
that right,
right,
Robin?
7 o'clock.
I noticed when I was looking at your bio that you've done a lot of films co-produced with women and that you have directed them, and you are a woman. I'm wondering, since the struggles of women in Hollywood are kind of legendary, how has your experience been making films in Hollywood with women producers and as a woman director?
Well, I've been very fortunate to work with some wonderful women. I made a choice. The first screenplay I sold had a male protagonist, as did the second one. But what I felt looking around Hollywood is that women were being relegated to roles in which basically all they had to do was show up wearing a towel, and and their part in the movie was complete.
Mm-hmm.
And I had made friends with actors who really complained about the kinds of roles that they were being given. And I grew up seeing the movies of kind of a golden age in Hollywood with Betty Davis and Katharine Hepburn, and women were driving the audience then. And they made movies that featured women at the center of stories. So I decided that I was going to try to write as many of those movies as I could. That put me into a certain niche within Hollywood. And that niche was a person whose movies don't get made. Because they did not make movies with female protagonists. So it really took pushing the movie Shag into existence and pushing the movie Little Women into existence for people to acknowledge what I always knew, which is that women are at least half of the audience, if not more.
That's right.
And that movies like, at that time, there were movies like Beaches and Steel Magnolias, and then, of course, Titanic was an entirely female-driven audience, that these movies are always considered by mainstream Hollywood as being flukes. The received wisdom was that women didn't go to the movies. And I went to the marketing head at Columbia, Sony Pictures owned Columbia, with Little Women. And he was a person who had four daughters.
Ah.
And I said, women go to the movies together. They go back again with their sister. They go back again with their best friend. They go in groups with their book club. They go again with their mother. I said, men send each other to the movies. Women go to the movies relationally. And I think that it is worth the risk on this movie that no one wants to make, Little Women. If you just didn't spend a fortune on it, I think you're going to make money. And he bought the argument.
And did he make money?
And he pushed it through. Yes, it's one of their highest grossing films of that time for its budget. It was a $16 million budget at a time when movies then were routinely costing about $90
million. Wow.
And so we made do with very little, and it was all women involved in it. You know, there were a few key heads of department positions that weren't women. But that was kind of the thin end of the wedge for that. Didn't get a lot easier to make these kind of movies, but at least there was something to point to.
Is that attitude changing in Hollywood? Do you think the studios are picking up more films with female protagonists, or is it still a struggle?
It's still a struggle for movies with female protagonists to get made, for sure. Where movies and where female filmmakers in particular enter is through the side door of indie film.
Mm.
So the Sundance screenwriting labs and directing labs and their festivals, Essential. That's where Ava DuVernay came from, who's now doing Wrinkle in Time.
Yeah.
When I met her, she had won Best Director at Sundance for a film called Middle of Nowhere. Fantastic movie. And I had seen it. I was moderating a panel of directors and talking to her. And I said, you must have every agent in the world knocking on your door. And she said, not one person has called.
Huh.
And so she was unrepresented, fabulous filmmaker. And through the efforts of some around her, including myself, she got representation. And she then was able to do Selma. Once she did Selma, once again, completely blanked.
Really? You
know, she did not get an offer to direct for a year. She did Queen Sugar for Oprah Winfrey, who was one of the people who believed in her.
Uh-huh.
And so finally, at some point, Wrinkle in Time came together for her. And it's a $100 million budget. It's the largest budget that a female director has ever overseen. And it's shocking that that's notable, honestly.
Yeah, it is.
Because she's a tremendously talented director.
What do you see as the future for women in Hollywood then? Do you see this as an opening of the door, the big door?
Well, because I mentor a lot, I see the generation that's coming up. And the younger women are creating alliances with each other in a very impressive way. They're also enormously talented, and they've been making movies their entire lives. They started making movies on their iPhones when they were children.
Uh-huh.
And honestly, they're not going to stand for it. Also, the marketplace is changing because people can now actually stream their own movies. You don't have to sort of stand in line, knocking on a door, waiting for one of the seven studios to let you in. So I do think it's going to get a lot better for women, and it's certainly going to usher in a kind of new golden age, I think, in indie film.
What impact do you think the new golden age of television is having on both the development of independent story ideas and women in film?
I think that this, what's happening right now with television and also streaming, having that kind of access to programming, is that more women have been allowed to direct in television than ever before.
Uh-huh.
And there are more points of view represented, minority points of view, as well as female points of view, more international points of view. So I think that it's only going to do great work for the audiences who want to see something besides standard studio fare. And certainly the studios have almost ceded that ground completely. You know, we're in an age of the Marvel comic movie. And because they gave up, in a sense, on their audience, that audience did not go away. They migrated to smaller screens, and they are interested in longer forms and binge viewing and so forth. I think it's a great time to be a storyteller.
Yeah, I did. I have noticed, and I guess I attributed the international, the requirement for international acceptance or box office to moving the whole comic book blockbuster film production for the larger studios. I was happy to hear you saying that indie films need to attract an international audience that is not necessarily blockbuster, but more art house oriented.
That's right. And the festivals are there. This film has been invited to Münchenfest, which is in Munich in Germany in late June, and also about a week after that at the Edinburgh Festival in Scotland. So, you know, the festivals are there, and they do invite American movies, and it's a real thrill, actually, to get to go, because then you meet the sisterhood and brotherhood of filmmakers around the world at these places who are trying to do exactly the same thing that you're doing. It's really a very heady feeling.
That would be great fun.
Yeah.
This is a silly technical question, but when you're making a film and doing the final post-production on it, you want international distribution. Do you have to do dubbing? You have to dub different versions?
No, the people who sign on to be the distributors in other countries take care of the dubbing, and the filmmaker doesn't have a lot of say. I know they're probably, Martin Scorsese can say, it can't be dubbed, you know, it can only use subtitles, but, you know, at my level, you're just glad if somebody says, we have three screens in Turkey. You're like, oh, great.
I know you're being humble about your level, but you are on the board of directors of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences.
That's right. I'm a governor for the writers branch. Every branch has three governors, and I can be modest about that too. I was a first runner up for that, and then the person who was in the job died. And
oops,
that's how I got in.
Yeah, you said you had some stories about taking the film Wakefield to Telluride 4 days after you finished it. You want to tell us one of those stories?
Yes. You know, because we were sort of doing everything on a nickel and a prayer, we we were finishing our film and doing post on it, which is the part where you do the sound mixes mm-hmm. and you record the score and you mix that in and you color time the thing. And then there are a lot of VFX, visual effects, about 150 of them, which are seamless. You won't even know they're there. But they had to do with making things be wintry when it wasn't really winter, uh-huh. being fall when it wasn't really, really fall, and so forth. We had to fill in rain because when we were doing some rain shots, it only rained for part of the day. And so we had to create rain. So there are a lot of visual effects, and they were to the lowest bidder, which were some people in Russia. So we spent the summer going in and out of these different labs that had made fabulous deals for us. But our deal was to take the leavings. So if somebody else was in there and then there were three extra days, we would go in and take those 3 days.
Oh my gosh.
And so we were piecing together our post all summer. And then we got accepted into Telluride. And there was this complete nail biter of the last 3 weeks. Is will we have our VFX back from Russia? Will we have time to go in and do another color timing on that before we have to send this DCP, which is the digital way that movies are shown now,
yes.
send this to Telluride? We literally carried it to Telluride when we went. So that it was a beautiful experience. If anybody who's listening is a tremendous cinephile, I really recommend going to Telluride. It is the most wonderful festival.
What time of year does that happen?
It happens every Labor Day weekend. And it's a small town, and there aren't that many places to stay, and they don't sell more tickets than there are places to stay.
Hmm.
And people all over the West drive there for that weekend and stay in these, you know, ski lodges and so forth. It's a box canyon, so the town is quite small. And there's a beautiful gondola that takes you up the mountain to one of the screening rooms. We were staying up there. My last night in Telluride, we were riding on this gondola at night, and I saw a shooting star go by at eye level right next to me on that huge Rocky Mountain. I mean, I guess it's the Tetons.
Did that feel like an omen?
It didn't feel like necessarily an omen for me because I try not to set up expectations for myself. But it did feel like a beautiful way to end that festival.
So, we're running out of time, but I want to ask you about your screenplay development process.
Okay.
How does it start?
Well, in this case, because it started with a short story,
yeah.
there's a process of breaking that down and beginning to visualize what it will look like. And also to find the beginning, middle, and end of the story. And then other decisions follow from that. So there's a kind of outlining and thinking deeply about process that every writer has to go through no matter what they're writing.
Mm-hmm.
And then after you have that, there's a writing period in which you're not doing a very good job. And then you do another draft and it gets a little bit better. So that's pretty much it. And in between, you try to get people to read your screenplay.
I was going
to
ask, do you share it with people?
And tell you what you absolutely have to change.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Who is your favorite collaborator?
In that process?
Yeah.
Oh, I have so many wonderful friends that we all read for each other. So I don't really have any favorites. I'm just grateful that anyone is there.
Robin Swycourt, I can't tell you how delighted I am that you took the time to join us. Robin Swycourt is the screenwriter and director of the film Wakefield, which is going to premiere here at Vashon Theater tomorrow night, Thursday, May 4th. One last question. What is the favorite of the screenplays that you've written? What is it which of your screenplays do you feel the closest to? You've written a lot of them.
I've written a lot of them. I think the project I cared most about was The Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
Really?
Yes. And the where it ended up on screen was something that was rewritten by Eric Roth, wonderful screenwriter.
Mm-hmm.
So I tend to look back to the drafts, you know, before there was anyone else. And I think back to those and I feel a kind of nostalgia and sorry that that didn't actually, you know, get made as I had written it, because my Benjamin Button was a jazz musician. There was a lot of music.
Oh,
a lot of music.
Maybe you can do a remake.
Well, I don't know. But, you know, sometimes you let go of the past.
Yeah.
But I did love that a lot. I love that character. He was such a beautiful outsider.
What a good time you have.
I do.
Thank you again. It's been a good time having you here with us.
Thank you.
Has been Real Talk. I'm Susan McCabe, your host. And next Wednesday, there will be no Real Talk because there will be Give Big Day, a live program, 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. here in the Storefront Studio all day long, where you will hear the stories of your favorite nonprofits and have an opportunity to give to all of them. Please remember to give to Voice of Vashon. We are the nonprofit that supports all other nonprofits. Thanks for listening to Real Talk. May 17th, we're going to have Woody Pollack here to help you parents understand how to deal with your teens in the digital age. Thanks for listening.